I would like to introduce our speaker for this evening, Julie St. Jay from Irvine, California.
Hi everybody, I'm Julie St. John and I'm an alcoholic. Very grateful to be here. Thank you, Lee. Good friend, long time warrior on this road that we're on. I'm going to try and have a good time while I'm giving this talk. At least I will. I don't know if you will. But I remember when somebody told me that when I was like, just have fun with it. I'm like, have fun with it. I was like this uptight, wound, how do you have fun with giving it? But now I just crack myself up. I just tell my own jokes and laugh at my own jokes. So anyway, I'm not going to quote the big book or that's not the kind of speaker that I am. Like, tell my story of what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, do the best I can to have fun because I have a podium on. That's what I'm going to do. So I was really worried. I had a funeral earlier today that I was going to be like, in major buzzkill mode, but, and I too, like Darnell, am not as enthusiastic as our first reader was, but, okay, I feel walking in here, I want to thank the committee as well, because just coming in here, I feel like I've just gotten a big AA hug, like I'm with my people, and this is, I mean, just the hard work that you do to pull this together, to have a nice little gift basket in our room, I mean, and be greeted so nicely. And it's just like getting a hug after a long, hard day. And, you know, I went to a funeral for an 8-year-old, and that was tough, you know. I just sponsored the mom of this little guy and was there the day he was born. So I thought, oh, my God, how am I going to drive to Santa Maria and then give an AA talk? But, you know, coming in here and just getting this hug from all of you, I'm like, I'm okay, you know, this is what we do, this is life, and I was grateful to be there. I'm grateful that I can help her through this for as long as it takes, you know. So anyway, before I go down the buzzkill path, I let's see, I've been sober for a very long time, January 31st, 1991, so I'm well into my 31st year, and, you know, never took any breaks, constant, like 31 years of daily, weekly, monthly meetings. And so I say we're warriors on this path, you know. I mean, sometimes you don't want to go to a meeting, but coming in here and seeing all of you, it's just like my heart is played open, and you guys are right there. And that's how it's been my whole sobriety, and I wouldn't have it any other way. So I'll start at the beginning. I am worked since I'm 15 years old, and I'm 66 now, and not that I'm bitter, I'm just tired. And I've been an executive assistant my whole career. I work for the CEO and president of a company, and I've done that for the last 20 years, so I'm on my toes. I know they're probably wondering, like, when is this old bat going to retire? TikTok lady, get out of here. Nope, I'm still there, and I love work, and I'm going to keep doing it as long as they're willing to pay me. So, let's see. I grew up, well, I was born in South Dakota, small town in South Dakota. I have this little Swedish mother, and she had three kids in rapid succession. We were born like July, August, September, a year apart, a year and a month. And then she got divorced, and she was like 20. And so she meets my stepdad, and they moved to California. And I'm sure it was to like get out of Dodge, because she was the black sheep in her family of nine, you know, being divorced so young and with three kids. And so they moved to California, to Los Angeles. I don't think they really knew that it was East Los Angeles. And they moved into this little downstairs duplex that was, you know, going to be their starter home. And they had two bedrooms, and they had, you know, right away two more boys. I have four brothers. And so it was crowded, but there was a lot of love. And then when I was, I think, 15, we moved next door to a real house. And that was kind of, I mean, my dad worked in a machine shop. My mom volunteered. She, you know, set score at all my brother's games. And as did my dad, we went to church. We prayed before dinner. We ate meat and potatoes. My dad, being from the Midwest, was a hunter and fisherman. And, you know, my life, I would say my life would have been a lot easier if I were Mexican. I wanted to be. maybe by association. All four of my brothers married Mexican women, so that helped. But growing up, I just remember feeling like, I don't know, less than, better than, you know, they didn't have any money, but they sent us all to Catholic school, and I went to girls' Catholic high school, and, you know, I like to say every member in a family has their role. My role was goody two-shoes. I'm the second oldest. It's just the role I took on. I don't know. Maybe it's the second oldest thing. I don't know. But I noticed everything. I had it stored away in my head as a kid. I knew we were poor. I always hated our cars, our furniture, the food we ate. Why did I worry about this? It never bothered my brothers to, you know, this is a thing, but it bothered me. And I remember in the neighborhood we grew up in, there was a lot of games, and standing at the corner market huffing glue, you knew to step over him, you knew not to make eye contact. The kid across the street had joined a gang and committed murder. The guy next door had a murder charge down the street, and so you just learn to watch your back. I don't ever remember feeling afraid. Almost the contrary, you know, especially when my brother joined the gang, and then I was felt safe. They all knew I was a stepsister. But growing up, I don't know, I had an ulcer when I was 10, okay? I just worried about everything. I'm telling you, I can still be like this today, uptight, wound tight. Sometimes it serves me well. It serves me well in my job when I'm on top of every little detail. Although in my later age, like this last year, I'm kind of like, you'll figure it out. I'm kind of tired. But so growing up, though, you know, like my dad, he had this fascination with camouflage. I don't know if it's because he was a hunter. He had a blind at Lake Isabella, a duck blind. He would sneak up after work into the local mountains, and I would see him come rolling up the street in his camouflaged Baja Volkswagen with a big dead deer strapped to it. And I just remember, like, oh, my stomach. I was doing, like, curtain patrol. Like, I hate my family. My God, who are these people? Nobody else had camouflage boats in the yard. Nothing in the yard, you know? And then he'd hang that deer up in the, you know, maybe out here, some places in San Maria, that's okay to hang a deer in front of your house. In East Los Angeles, there was none of that going on. And we had to eat that. I mean, it was common to come home from school and find dead geese and duck in the bathtub or in the freezer. And then, you know, this is going to date me, but remember those grinders, those meat grinders? I still have those vivid memories of getting out the meat grinder for the venison. Ugh. When people ask me as an adult, you know, have you tried venison? I'm like, yeah, never again. Part of my life is over. But anyway, it, you know, there was, like I said, a lot of love going on. There was also a lot of dysfunction. My mom was very busy in the middle of the night, you know, cleaning the walls from the smoke. And because they both smoked Pall Mall Reds and never opened a window. Not that I judge. But, yeah, she liked these little white pills, and I never knew what it was. I just knew that she was weird, and, like, she would cry or lock herself in the bedroom for days. And I was just like, who is my family? And I had this ongoing list of all these things, as I mentioned, but I also had a list of all the things I was not going to be when I grew up. There's not going to be, I don't know why margarine bothered me. That bothered me. just all the food we ate, everything. You know, nobody, I'm never going to have my lights turned off or the phone turned off. I'm not going to hook into the neighbor's electricity with the big one extension cord, okay? And the fighting over finances, and I was going to be different. And that was my, you know, I'm not going to smoke, I'm not going to do this. Being the goody two-shoes that I was, I did that for a good while. And I got, you know, out of high school and kind of distanced myself from my family as much as I could. I got married when I was 21, married a big college football star and this big giant wedding. And I used to say he had groupies. They were always at our house, which made for a party atmosphere. So they, like, it was like Thursday night, Friday night, all weekend barbecues at our house. They followed him. They were his groupies, and they were always at our house. And, you know, it was fine at the time, but I wasn't partying like they were. And then a couple years into that marriage, I had my first child, a little girl, and I was just over the moon. I just thought, this is what God put me on this earth to be. I'm going to give her everything I ever had, you know, that kind of mother. And so I was just over the moon, and 3 years later, you know, I'm still working. I worked at another thing that will date me, if some of the older people remember Broadway department stores. Their corporate office was in East Los Angeles, and I worked there, and for like 11 years. And then, what was the next place? Another business, California Mortgage or something like that, another one that closed down. But I started building, you know, what I thought were all the things that were supposed to fix me. I was driving a Porsche. I thought, all right, I've arrived. I have a Porsche. And I have, you know, this little baby. And I have nice furniture. And I, you know, have nice clothes. And why, I must have the formula wrong because I'm still uptight and disgruntled. And, you know, I do remember, like, the first time that I got drunk. And it was before I was married and I was younger, and I just remember this out-of-body experience. I was like up here like, wow, look at you saying all the stuff you really want to say. Because I was telling him that I used to like you, and I really don't like you. So I thought, I better cool that. You know, I can't let that cat out of the bag. And so this wedding, 3 years after my daughter, my son is born, both big kids, 8 and 9 pound kids, just the love of my life. And after Jordan was born, I find myself, I don't know, I want to say a year later, with a really bad drug habit. This was the early 80s, and these, you know, weekend parties, they brought some cocaine around, and I remember trying that for the first time while everybody's drinking, and the wine, and it was wine after work every day, and the box of wine in the refrigerator, and it had, you know, the amount that I was drinking had increased, and I just thought, I'll try it once, because I know better. I've watched my family, the neighborhood I come from. I know why all these people went to jail. You know, my brother had to go into the military. He'd gotten stabbed out in front of our house and the helicopters and, you know, all of that drama. And my younger brother had started dealing drugs. And, you know, mom was protecting him and the big customer. And I'm just like, okay, I knew. So I'm so smart. I know better, right? So I will know when to say when. So I knew when the first time I tried that I really liked it. Like, I didn't like it a little bit. It wasn't a little bit like. It was a lot of like. Like, I knew there wasn't enough money like. And so I had to keep this a secret. So I find myself pregnant with my third child with a pretty serious daily drug habit. And I'm drinking every day to come down from this to try and get sleep so I can get up and go to work and keep all these balls in the air with the three kids in the schools and, you know, keeping up this good girl image and go to work. And it was just a lot. And so I give birth to this child like a month early. He barely weighed 5 pounds. I mean, I was mortified. Being a good little Catholic schoolgirl, I hated myself. I was looking at him and flinched, like, look what you did. Oh my God, you are a monster. You could have killed him. How could you? You know better. You see what this, and yet, you know, if I could have chosen to stop drinking, I would have. But I had to, like, stay pickled enough just to maintain. And, you know, I wasn't fall down, you know, bumping the walls, blackout drinking because of cocaine, but haven't gotten there yet. So, I give birth. I wish I could say I got sober sometime shortly thereafter, but I live like that, like we do, for another 5 years. And we have to circle the drain and circle the drain. And meanwhile, I'm watching my family circle the drain. You know, my brother got out of the military, and he was just drinking. So, you know, he got married, and his wife would show up with a black eye occasionally. You know, there was always drama. You never knew. He had a hot temper, and you never knew when a fight was going to break out. You know, just that family disease, what's going to happen tonight, you never know, at the holidays. But it just seemed like everybody else's family was the same, so it just didn't seem different. And so in that 5 years, you know, the relationship starts going bad and sour, and that we start losing the house, and it goes into foreclosure. And my best thinking was, well, I'll just, I don't care. I was so angry at God. Like, I thought I had a hard, what the hell? How did I have this hard childhood and now this? And it was maintenance drinking, you know. It was staying pickled enough to not think about what was happening. And we lose the house, and we had to move my 3 kids into one room of my parents' house while my brother is dealing in the next room. Like, I'm talking big time dealing. And you know, fencing stolen property, and like 100 people in and out, and people with names like Bear and Hey Hey. And, you know, I've got my kids that I'm taking to this private school, and, you know, we sleep on the floor, and this was for a couple years before I got sober. And I'd get together with my ex-husband, and we'd go to hotels on the weekend, and I would just be like, I didn't care. When we get our next check, we'll figure it out. That was kind of the mentality. And all of the stuff that I had acquired just got rained on, and I just didn't care. And I couldn't bring myself to care. And as Clancy used to say, we cared so much, that's why we didn't care. And so what happened to get me here? Well, that. But you know, I remember hearing in the middle of the night those commercials, if you know somebody with a problem, they should call AA. So I bravely dialed that number and told them my sister had a problem. And they said, well, your sister should go to AA. And I said, well, she can't. She has kids. Like, what did I know about AA? I knew nothing. And it was crazy. What happened to get me into AA was my husband, he didn't want to live with my crazy family, so he went and lived with his brother, who was going through a divorce because he cheated with his secretary, this blonde biatch, and so he was staying there, and then he calls me and tells me, well, actually, I got arrested first. I got arrested, and I just remember thinking when they were going to put the handcuffs on me, like, I'm a mother. I just had my nails done. Like, what? And I did. I just thought that. And I'm a Catholic schoolgirl. Like, what? So they didn't care. So that was my, you know, my moment of, I think it's Charlie Carney that talks about when you have, like, a station wagon full of all your issues, and you slam on the brakes, and everything comes flying forward, and you just have to, like, recognize, like, look at you. You can't do this anymore. This, the gig is up, and it's done, you know. And I remember in jail they said, like, stop crying. It's not that big a deal. Like, you don't know. So I get out of my big 6-hour jail stay. Got it. And I remember I couldn't even say it when I was new in the room until some girl in AA said, "Oh, honey, I've been arrested in the parking lot at the meeting beating up some girl. You're fine." I'm like, all right, you guys speak my language, okay. And so I remember I still had insurance for my husband, and I had lost that last job. They said, "We like you, but you have to show up on time." And I couldn't. I just couldn't. I couldn't do it. And so I'd gotten fired from that job. I had bleeding ulcers, but my kids were 5, 8, and 11. My daughter was the oldest. She was taking care of me. Like, she knew to run and get mom milk when I was having an ulcer attack. I just couldn't keep it together, and that's not how it was supposed to turn out, you know. So my kids and mom dropped me off at this rehab covered by the insurance, and I walk in. Oh, and then right before I get dropped off, I was trying to find my husband. I couldn't find him, and turns out him and this blonde woman decided they liked each other, so he called to tell me it was over. And then I think that same week, I forgot to put oil in my now 20-year-old Volkswagen I'm driving, and the engine blew. So I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I was just like, the wheels had fallen off. Okay, I had no other options. And so I go to this rehab. They drop me off at the end of a plank, it felt like. I walk in, I look around, and I just remember thinking, like, this is a new level of low. Like, who are these weirdos? They're all happy. This guy was at the podium crying, which I hadn't laughed in a long time. I was in the back row laughing so hard. I had to, like, step out for a moment. I just thought, this is the twilight zone. This is my punishment. And, you know, it took all of 24 hours, and I'm thinking, well, if that loser can get it, maybe I can get it. And, you know, 24 more hours, and I'm like, kumbaya, let's take over, I'll fire with sobriety. And, you know, my dad and brothers pitched in and put an engine in my Volkswagen, and I started this process very slowly of, you know, it's not fast recovery. But I would come to these meetings, and we would laugh, and I would hear other people talk this language of the heart that we speak, and I slowly started healing, and my kids started healing. And it was at 9 months of sobriety, and my husband at the time had moved down to Orange County. Like, I was so sheltered living in East LA, I knew nothing about Orange County. The only thing I knew was that was where all the white people lived. And I just thought, okay, and he walked into a new life, and here I am trying to, like, save up enough money to get an apartment, you know, and just overwhelmed. You know, I hadn't filed taxes in 6 years, and I was then claiming 15 dependents. You know what we do. And let's see, I had warrants for my arrest for tickets I hadn't paid. I had $1,100 in parking tickets. I had, you know, these ulcers were back, and my fillings were falling out, and I had water in my knees. I was just such a mess. But I was sober, and I was happy. And I used to say that I looked 20 years older than I was, but now that I'm 30 years older than I was, I didn't look this good. But anyway, so that's how I started my journey. It was not easy, but it was fun, and my heart, like I said, was laid open, just like when I walked in here tonight, same feeling, like I'm with family, and I'm so grateful for that. So, yeah, my husband and this woman decided to get married. You know, like, the kids went to go stay with them. It was supposed to be temporary, and of course, I made him sign something. He was going to try to pull a fast one, and he did. Filed for divorce and custody, and was, like, garnishing my first check at my new job. And I just would come in these rooms and cry, and, you know, they got married. We used to fondly refer to this woman as Hori Lori. I know there's no Hori Loris in the room, right? But sometimes quickly, sometimes never. So I don't want to be perfect. I never want to be perfect. I tried that. It didn't work in the altar. So, yeah. So they're getting married, and they have my kids now, and I'm paying them, like, my whole check, and I'm just crying and AA. But I'm sober, and I'm slowly taking care of all of this wreckage, you know, and like we do. I met Ron during our noontime meetings. He worked downtown, and I worked downtown in the high-rise. We were both in the same building. And, you know, typical AA, I had three kids. He had four kids. We're both paying child support up the wazoo. Neither of us had any money. You want to go on a date? Okay. So, yeah. We've been married now. How many years? I don't even know. 24, 5, 26, 27. Sorry. He planned the whole wedding. He's great. So, yeah, we have a good life. And, you know, all of that is behind us now. And all those things that we thought were just going to be so hard for so long have changed. And now it's new things, you know. It's always going to be something. We got married at 5 years of sobriety. And the kids are doing well down in Huntington Beach. And my the judge, you know, my husband, ex-husband wouldn't give me the kids back, so we finally, like, moved down to Orange County so the kids aren't upset, and then you can have the kids back. So that's what we did. And, you know, my daughter was a senior in high school and writing her essay about her hero, her mom, and captain of the cheerleading squad. And my son Jordan was just this big, massive, gentle giant, mama's boy, 6'4", 250 pounds. You know, he played varsity as a freshman all 4 years. He was lineman of the year. So he was a big football player, just like his dad. And my youngest son, Jared, who I could have killed, who was born at 5 pounds, he gave us a run for our money. You know, like, he was, he had every ism from the day he was born, you know, that we have. He's better than, he's less than. If he can't be the best player on the team, he's not going to play. You know, he's going to tell dad that all his schoolwork's come, you know, because we shared custody. He's going to tell dad all his schoolwork's done. He's going to come to me, and he's failing out and everything. So I got to get tutors and, like, that kind of run for my money. I mean, like, but I'll tell you, going to make me get emotional, but he's in his 30s now. He's never had a drink of alcohol. Mm-hmm. Or taken a pill or smoked a cigarette, and that's what you gave me. You know, here, I don't deserve that, but that's, those are the gifts we get in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So my job started getting better. I interviewed for the chairman of an oil company where I worked for many years. I got to meet presidents of the United States. I got to meet George Bush and President Carter, and I got invited to President Reagan's office because of who I worked for. My boss at the time was the chairman of Arco Oil, and he was also the chairman of the Reagan Presidential Foundation, so he golfed with President Reagan, and they were very close. And so, you know, just amazing things happen in sobriety. Of course, I took care of all those warrants and back taxes. It took a long time, and you know, it's nice being married to an attorney that can help get your record expunged. I think it's like Carl Morris or something that talks about, you know, we're like a football team. We huddle together. You get a dog. Get your record expunged. You, you know, run out and do this. Get your tattoos removed off your face. And, and that's what we do. We come in here. You know, you can't do this at the church club or the school PTA. But in here we get to do those things and do it happily to give back so that we can keep what we have. And so that was 5 years of sobriety. And at 10 years of sobriety, I'm still working, you know, as an executive assistant. To, I changed jobs to down in Orange County for the chairman of another company. And I mean, I couldn't believe it. I remember flying on a private jet, meeting, who was on this private jet? Tom Selleck, his dad and brother, and me. And my boss was like, we're going to fly in the other jet. You fly with the Selleck back because they were opening a golf course or something. And I'm like, all right, I can do this. I'm thinking, if they only knew who I was, you know, like, I was the liaison with the Secret Service and the FBI when these presidential visits would come to our office. And they, at one point, were taking socials of participants. I thought, oh, Lord. But, you know, like I said, we get our record this bunch, and luckily they never asked for my social. And so, yeah, all because I knew how to take shorthand, you know, and learned to work hard in AA. And I don't even know if they teach shorthand anymore. This old thing for you young people. An abbreviated writing skill. And so at 10 years of sobriety, my son is, Jordan's the captain of the football team. It's just like the best thing ever. The whole football team is at our house every day for lunch like a herd of locusts. You know, but when you miss out on time, you're just grateful for any, you know, all of that. And he said, Mom, the football players and me were going to go to Lake Havasu for spring break. It's going to be so fun. So they met at our house, and we went shopping for him and packed up his bag. And, you know, he come back in the house three times, and he just kept saying, Mom, this is the best day of my life. I love you so much, Mom. And they drove off, and I got a phone call at work at 11 that there was an accident, a crash. His friend was driving, and he crashed, and Jordan died. So just like that, you know, poof, gone. You know, my big fill-the-door giant kid, you know, his shoes are still sitting there. What am I supposed to do with that, you know? And what's interesting is I remember when I was newer, hearing, I would go sit in my car at lunch from work and listen to AA speakers. And I heard this speaker, John James. I don't know if you maybe know him. I think his wife was an actress, but anyway, good guy. And he had lost his 7-year-old son. And I just remember being so drawn to that talk that I listened to it over and over. And he had lost his, he passed away a couple years ago. And, but what he had done from losing his son was he created the grief recovery. I don't know. It's a handbook. It's a book that he wrote. And so I remember that. And, you know, like this girl this morning, Josette, who lost her little boy, I sponsored her for many years, and she used to come with me to speak, and she just felt so drawn to my story about Jordan. And I'm just thinking, like, you know, there's some connection that she felt drawn to me, and now I get to walk her through this. Just since, you know, I reached out to John James for his grief recovery book, I started going to these grief meetings, you know, talk about a buzzkill meeting. Everybody's kid is dead, right? Ugh. And, you know, you hang around any meeting long enough, you become chair or secretary or speaker getter, you know. And so I said, all right, we're going to change up the format of this sad meeting. We're going to talk about what our child was like and what happened to them and what it's been like since they died. And I'll tell you, it changed the whole dynamic of the meeting. We got to tell funny stories about our kid, you know, like my one friend in there, like her little 7-year-old died, and she said, you know, like right after Christmas, Mom, Santa has the same wrapping paper that we do. You know, I mean, people don't want to hear stories about the dead kid. They just don't. After like 30 days, they're like, oh, you're still talking about that, you know? And we just want to talk about them and bring them to light. And so we set up, of course, a scholarship fund for dumb football players. And I went, you know, that meeting really helped. And I contacted John James, and he came out and passed out his book and gave a presentation, you know. And these are the things we get to do here. You know, I had such a leg up going through that loss because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had learned to meditate with my sponsor for many years, solid meditation, like hardcore, from when I was 2 years sober, like meet at her house every Saturday and do 2 20-minute sessions, you know, sometimes a 40-minute solid session of just meditating. And that's a practice that it takes discipline. And there's this Buddhist monk in West LA called Shinzen, and he talks about, always talks about, the formula for suffering. And the formula for suffering in Buddhism is pain, so no matter what kind of pain you have, times resistance equals suffering. And I just thought, why don't we know that in AA? You know, if you have this pain and you allow it, like the third step, it's like a foggy morning that dissipates. Now, it comes back, right? But the practice to allow, you know, with equanimity, this pain to just be, helped me so much, you know. Jordan and I were going to take college classes together because my sponsor is a doctor and has a cattle prod. And I've always felt less than in the environments that I worked in. She said, you need to go back to college. I'm like, fine. I did not want to. I felt too old. I felt too fragile, you know, but we do what we're asked to do here, and it always turns out good. And so I went to this school, and, you know, inevitably these big football players would sit next to me or want to be in a study group with me or ask if, may I walk you to your farm at St. John? And it was just really nice to be around kids his age. And, you know, this kid lets me know he's around all the time. His jersey number was the same as his dad's. It was 74. I've been asked to speak. I show up and the address is 7400 Jordan Avenue. That's his name. You know, these kind of reminders are everywhere. And nonstop, you know, like I graduated in 74. So, you know, on our anniversary, we go to the restaurant and they say, oh, let me take you to your table. You're at table 74. And I'm like, of course we are, you know. I mean, so he's right there, you know. I mean, he's just right there. And I can honestly say in hindsight that his death gave me as many blessings as his life. I don't like admitting that. I don't want it to be true. But it's true. You know, it's just true. It broke me and rebuilt me into a better person. I can help Josette go through this last acute experience, my former sponsee. I mean, I don't want to be the conduit to death for everybody, which seems to happen sometimes too. Like, anybody died, send them to Julie. I'm just like, ah. But, you know, life has gone on and gotten better, and not just better, like incredibly good, you know. Like, I watched my family, you know, both parents are now deceased. My brother that was a year older in the gang, he died at 45 waiting for a liver transplant, drank in the parking lot. But his son, his oldest son, Jeffrey, is my godson, and I'm there for him. I talked to him in the parking lot, he called me. And my brother's second son, Josh, I give a cake to every year. He has 4 years of sobriety now. And I got to be there for my niece, you know, for her wedding, to send her flowers for my brother. This is what we get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm no saint. I'm not trying to, you know, please don't look at me, I'm throwing a halo. I don't want to do these things, but when we're called to do these, it's a blessing. You know, I had in this rehab, I remember them saying, make a list of everything you want in AA because you're going to get that. And then all my bitterness and anger, I thought, oh really, is that your little treatment activity? And so I made my list, and I wrote on my list that I wanted to quit smoking, because I'd been smoking for a long time, always said I wouldn't, and I did. I wanted to maybe exercise, but probably not. And I wanted new furniture, and I wanted a new car, and I wanted someone else to pay for that car and the insurance. That was my spiritual list. And of course, all those things came true. You know, my sponsor made me stop smoking at 2 years of sobriety. And, you know, I didn't put on that list that my child that I almost killed would be influenced by this trickle-down effect of Alcoholics Anonymous and never have a drink. I didn't put on there that I would be able to help other women who've lost children. I just put on there that my daughter would name her daughter after me, and my nephew I just spoke to would name his little girl after me. I mean, that's incredible gift that, you know, I just didn't think about. So, anyway, I wrote, finishing up in college, I wrote my final essay comparing, it was a religious studies class that I took, and so I wrote this paper comparing Alcoholics Anonymous to Buddhism. They're very, very similar. Buddhism is not a religion. It's a philosophy that states that all of our problems are of our own making and centered in our minds, which kind of accurately describes all of us, right? And it's defined also by these four noble truths. And the first noble truth in Buddhism is life is suffering. I mean, just to know, we all know that. Life is suffering. And the second noble truth in Buddhism is we suffer due to our attachments. And the third noble truth is there's a way to stop suffering. And the fourth noble truth basically leads you to what they call their Eightfold Noble Path, which is right living, right actions, right speech, helping others, you know, basically all that we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because we do those things, we get to live comfortably without a lot of pain. I mean, even if we have pain, there's still a day doesn't go by that we don't, you know, laugh or reflect or have something of growth that we can share with someone else. I take being a mother and a grandmother very seriously. I don't put it on the back burner behind everything. I just don't do that. And, you know, to have the love and admiration of your children, to have my son on the other side, it's just, I mean, it's just such a blessing and incredible. You know, Ron and I have traveled, and of course all those debts are paid off now. Now we're considering retiring at some point. Like my daughter's, her firstborn child, she named her Jordan Juliana, just Jordan and I. And then her last daughter, youngest daughter, I should say, she named her Juliet. She said, am I only doing the Julies? I said, absolutely not. So they moved to Tennessee, and they did. So she said, Mom, I don't want to put any pressure on you, but we're building you a house, too, right on our property. So here I've been praying and praying for, like, some kind of sign from God for retirement. Like, it's really expensive to live here, although I love California. And here she comes up with this idea, and I'm like, can I have a different idea, God? Can I have a different plan? I don't like Tennessee. I don't love Tennessee. I like California. So we're going to go and try it and see how it goes. And so when Lee asked if I would come and speak, I was like, yes, I'd be happy to. I want to see as much of California before, like, maybe the end of next year or something. We'll move to cold two-lane highway in Tennessee. Everything's like a country old store or something. Like, why is there tin stars everywhere, you know? Sure, I'll be fine. No judgment. You know, Ron, we've got to speak in Sweden. Got to do a lot of really awesome things. And, you know, on that list, so where I put I wanted a new car and someone else to pay for it. I work for the chairman and CEO of a car company, and I've gotten a brand new car that they pay for and the insurance for the last 20 years. So maybe one of the reasons I haven't retired, I don't know. Pay for my own car, I don't know. But I get two brand new cars every year. Ron gets one and I get one. And I don't know. So if you're new, make a list. You're going to get everything you want. Like, here it is. I think we had, like, maybe 15 years of sobriety. Ron got mouth cancer and he couldn't talk right. Or, you know, just had to go through a really hard time. Yeah. But he's gotten through that, you know. Like, he always says, they bomb the hut, you take care of, you know, what is that thing you say, they bomb the hut to get rid of the village, like, they just destroyed his mouth and swallowing, so he has to do this other alternate feeding, and it's just like, you know, a blip in the road that shows us we're still alive and we're still going to have to go through these things and live life, you know. It's all about how we view whatever we're going through. It could be a good thing or it could just be like life. And, you know, we choose to look at it like it's just life, it's just one more thing. And we ought to focus on the positive. We're still healthy otherwise. And, you know, I mean, my daughter's building the house, for God's sake. Still able to work and get good reviews. I told my daughter I'm going to be sending you my good reviews when I'm 80. Man, Julie's such a hard worker. Yeah. But it has served me well, you know. I wish I could say another member of my family has gotten sober. But my brother's son is, and the older one that is my godson is struggling. And I don't care what it takes, I will help him till without judgment, without anything, whatever you need. You know, I owe it to them. I love them with all my heart. And I'm just really, really grateful. I think my time is coming to an end. I don't want to start telling fibs. So I'm going to sit down. I love you guys. Thank you for my life. Thank you for asking me to come out. I have this beautiful place. Oh, my God, I couldn't ask for a better weekend. Thank you, guys.
I'd like to thank our readers, Leo and Janelle. Another round of applause for Julie.